the Briz Treadley podcast with your host, Andrew Dimmock.
Well, welcome everybody to this 12th. Episode for 2017 of the Briz Treadley podcast. It's great to have your company once again. I haven't quite managed the whole weekly schedule in the last little while, but there are all sorts of good reasons for that. I was on a bike ride last week where I rode the Cycle Queensland test. I rode the entire route of Cycle Queensland in 4 days. It's a 9-day event. That was good fun. But we're back in the studio this week, and we're back in the studio with my good friend Nicholas O'Donnell. Hi, Nick.
Andrew, how are you?
Look, excited because it is just coming up to one of the favourite times of the year. The last week of June has the building sense of anticipation.
To the first week of July.
Yes.
And the first week of July means only one thing for cycling fans, and it's Tour de France time.
Yes.
And I'm pretty excited too. I think we've got lots to talk about. It's a really, really interesting route this year with some really interesting characters and lots at stake for lots of people. And I think it's going to be a cracker. And if the Dauphiné, which is a warm-up event, is any indication of the kind of racing we're going to expect, I think we are in for a treat.
Well, just before we get on to describing the whole Tour de France then, let's have a little walk back perhaps through the events that lead into this Tour de France. Maybe let's go back to the Giro, because it's pertinent as well, because Quintana was at the Giro.
Indeed, and the fact that he was at the Giro and the racing in the Giro was so good and so intense and really full on those last mountain stages, and he put everything into the mountains to try and get enough distance to try and hold off Dumoulin, which he couldn't do. But I think that's kind of the reason that it counts him out from this tour, because it's strange enough, it's a real climber's tour, this route, and I think getting the third week, it's possibly going to rule him out. But he was excellent in the Giro, but Tom Dumoulin kind of did everything he possibly could right and triumphed in what was a brilliant Giro. I mean, all the Giros the last few years have all been great, but that was a great.
It was, and such a almost an old school type. It reminded me of the Indurain era,
absolutely,
and reminded me. Tom Dumoulin reminds me of Miguel Indurain so much, and the way he just races so calmly, but with passion, and yeah, he's terrific. I can't wait to see him in a couple of years, maybe next year, but maybe in a couple of years at the Tour, doing the same sorts of things. So that was the Giro, and as many people who listen to this podcast will know, Tom Dumoulin, who is a Dutch rider, won the Giro d'Italia, and Nairo Quintana was second. I think Nibali was third.
Yes.
The old stage of Vincenzo, but Nibali is not fronting up for this Tour de France.
Probably wisely, which makes him probably a pretty short price favourite for the Volta if he rides that, which he has ridden and won previously. So, yeah, no, I think he learned that lesson. He tried to do the double previously, and it's really hard. It's really hard, especially on a route like we've got this year, which is lumpy as all heck, with some pretty good climbers in really good form who are going to duke it out. So, yeah, very interesting.
And then the next thing that happens in terms of tour warm-ups is the Critérium du Dauphiné. It used to be called the Dauphiné Libre, but now the Critérium du Dauphiné. And what happened there?
Well, it all happened there. Yes. There was ups and downs. There was great. I mean, the strongest rider actually didn't win the race, strange enough. The best climber didn't win the race either. And the strongest rider and the best climber, he won a time trial, he won a mountain stage, was actually Richie Port. But through some negative riding by some of the other kind of competitors who were maybe trying to get one over him psychologically come July on the tour, Jacob Fuglsang was able to sneak up the road on the final stage and sort of pickpocket Richie Port, which was disappointing on the one hand, but I think also a tremendous motivator for Port on the other.
But I think also, even though Richie didn't win the race, he still won the hearts and minds on the last day too, even though when Fuglsang was up the road, the ride that Richie does as a solo time trial on the last climb is just magnificent.
It was amazing.
And only 10 seconds off winning the race.
Absolutely. And actually, there was a bit about that ride which reminded me of that kind of extraordinary ride Cadel Evans did in 2011 on that kind of critical stage towards where he put it all back in and pulled it all together and then outfoxed the Schleck brothers up that final climb to cement really his win. And I think there are some enormous parallels between Evans in 2011 and Port in 2017, which has got me very excited about Richie's prospects this year.
So let's step back for a second and look at the overview of the Tour de France. As per usual, it's a 21-stage Tour de France, and nice and neat for us because it starts on the 1st of July, so that's a good way for the first week or so at least to know what stage stage you're watching.
If it's Tuesday, I must be in Dusseldorf. Exactly. And it starts in Dusseldorf, Germany this year. And interesting, so back we've got a prologue start, which is kind of interesting. In fact, and the prologue, which is only 14 kilometres long, pancake flat, but it's only one of two time trials in the race. And the other time trial comes on stage 20.
Are we calling that one the prologue, the Tony Martin benefit or not?
Yeah, look, possibly. But there are a few other guys that may surprise there as well. I mean,
Rowan Dennis isn't there.
No, that's true. And he would have been one of the other big threats. But it's also the sort of stage that distance that one of the kind of sprinters who can time trial a bit.
Kittel.
Yep. Can do well on.
Yep.
You could even imagine Sagan Greipel. Possibly doing something, or yeah. Greipel indeed. So it's interesting because it's pancake flat.
Right.
And so that's stage one. And then the only other time trial is on stage 20, the penultimate stage, and it's only 22.5 kilometres. Again, you know, pancake flat with a small blip, a little climb about 1 kilometre with a max of 8%, and that's with 7K to go, but that's not going to trouble anyone. So time trialing is really, it's not really a factor in this year's tour. The time trials will not decide the winner.
Which is very interesting, and who does that favour of the top, say, five or six riders? Is there anybody who really misses out as a result?
I think potentially in a normal year you would say Froome, because Froome has always been a better time trialer than probably the other leading contenders.
Your Quintanas and your Nibalis, etc.
Most certainly.
Yeah.
Richie Porte, though, has always been a pretty very capable time trialist with his background coming from triathlon.
Yep.
And he's a former Australian national champion in the time trial. And in fact, he won the time trial at the Dauphiné with a cracking ride. And, you know, Froome, I'm going to be very interested to see. We'll talk a little bit more about him as to how well he goes, because he hasn't really had the runs on the board this year. So Froome, typically you think it might disadvantage, but maybe really I think the guys we're talking about are all kind of sensational climbers, and it's their climbing prowess is going to decide the winner this year.
And so then the rest of the shape of the tour, like there are so many interesting and different types of stages. It just doesn't seem like any sort of typical tour. They've done everything different, thrown it all away and started again.
Yeah, including, so there's 9 stages for the sprinters. We haven't had 9 stages for the sprinters in a very, very long time. Having said that, so there's stages 2, 4, 6, 7, 10, 11, 16, 19, and 21. Now, I've kind of put a pencil in stage 11 and 19 as real opportunities for the breakaway, because they're kind of those rolling kind of all day intermediate sort of stages where the legs are getting a bit tired. There've been some mountains in there, so that probably maybe only gives potentially 7 opportunities to sprinters, but 7 very good opportunities. So it's going to be there's lots of great prizes up for stakes for the sprinters. So,
but that also means, Nick, that just picking up intermediate points might not be enough for Sagan. It means that somebody gets a real roll on. Marcel Kittel or somebody gets a real roll on in stage wins, that might make the green jersey interesting.
It could well make the green jersey interesting. So someone like, say, if Greipel, you know, he hasn't been in super form in a tour for a little while, but if he came in and kind of grabbed 2 stage wins across those 9, or even 3, absolutely right, it makes it a bit more competitive. Though I do think, though, there's also, you know, another 7 climbing stages, plus another 3 stages that suit the punchers. So that's kind of 10. So there's actually the rest of the race is lumpy. Yeah. So Sagan, again, if he gets out and gets over some of those climbs and picks up those green jersey points on some of the stages that the other sprinters aren't going to keep with him, you know, he still is pretty hot favourite to win again. But you're right, because of those 9 flat stages, you know, what if Mark Cavendish gets up and wins 4 stages? Maybe he takes a second green jersey. It could happen. A little unlikely, though, I think.
And so then we look at some of the stages that I thought were sort of a bit strange to have in there. So stage 3, just a couple of stages in, is it like a one-day classic?
Absolutely. And it's kind of with a sort of finish that sort of suits the sort of Lage, Baston Lage kind of riders, a sort of a punchy, steepish. Yeah, that's right. So it's going to be interesting. So definitely the yellow jersey is going to change hands. So I think whoever takes a jersey on stage 1 holds it for stage 2. But stage 3, it changes hands. And depending on who picks it up, they potentially can likely hang on to it for a few days as well. But it's going to be a terrific stage. And so I've kind of penciled
Greg
in.
Van Avermaet,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Well, absolutely, with the form he's been in. So I penciled in stage 3 is definitely one of my stages to watch. And then the rest are really made up of some of the kind of the very many mountain stages, of which there's a real kind of interesting mixture of stages too. I mean, including like stage 13, for example, is only 100 kilometres.
Yes.
Like it's a really weird stage, but it's 100 kilometres, but it's got three Cat 1 climbs with a 25 kilometre downhill finish. So like, boom, light it up and maybe a pinch of stage. So who knows what's going to happen on that day and whether how close things are and whether there's an opportunity for one of the GC guys to kind of do some damage and maybe try and scoot downhill. So yeah, that's another kind of mystery and definitely a stage to watch, stage 13.
So if we keep sort of rolling through the stages chronologically, stage 5 is the first time that GC really probably takes shape because we've got an uphill finish, don't we?
We do, Cat 1 finish.
Into La Planche de Belleville.
Indeed, which
the
is...
The Plate of the Beautiful Girls, I don't know. I tried to translate.
And it has been used in the tour before, and it's been an interesting one. It's been often an indication as to who was doing well and who wasn't. The gradients reached 20% on that climb, so it's going to be steep in places. So it's interesting, but early in the stage, although you've got Valverde, who is riding for Quintana and has said that very publicly, but that's the sort of stage where you could see him maybe having a bit of dig himself. So that's the consolation prize. Alejandro, ride for Nairo, but we'll give you stage 5, have a crack, son.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a perfect stage for him. The steep slopes really suit his punchy sort of style.
Absolutely. Oh. So, yeah, so that's kind of fascinating. And then... So we've got sort of 6 and 7 back for the sprinters and then into stage 8 again. So there's a Cat 3, a Cat 2 and a Cat 1. It's kind of lumpy. Stage 9, then we're getting serious now. A couple of Cat 3s but a HC, a Hawk category climb. And we're starting to see who's doing well and who's maybe starting to struggle. Like, it doesn't finish on the HC, but it's a downhill finish from there. But it's the first kind of real significant climb after a day. In fact, there's a couple of... I beg your pardon, that was 3 Hawk category climbs that day.
3?
Yeah, so...
So what are they? What have we
they
got?
They are...
Is that the one in the Pyrenees?
So we've got Colabiche, Colombier, and Mont du Chat. So we're still in the Alps there.
Yep.
So
yep.
3 Hawk category climbs. So that is big. So there's thousands and thousands and thousands of metres of climbing that day.
Oh.
Ouch.
Oh, and there are so many stages that just look super, super hard. And the back end of the race that seems to be... Even though there's all these things in the lead-up, it still finishes with this super hard finish with stage 18. Is it 17 and 18?
Oh, 17 and 18 are ridiculous. Oh, stage 17 has a Cat 2, a Hawk category, a Cat 1, and a Hawk category.
Yes.
And then stage 18, Cat 3, Cat 1, Hawk category.
Finishes on the finishes Col du Izard.
That's right. And so 18, it finishes on top of the Izard, but 17 includes Col de la Croix, de Fer, and the double at the end of the Telegraph and Glibier before a downhill finish on 17. So 7 and 18 is actually where the race is decided. We'll know, once we get to 18, we'll know the winner because after that, there's a transition stage, a sprinter stage 19, the 20K time trial, then the Champs-Élysées 21.
And so you'd expect the time gaps to be big enough after all of that climbing that really the individual time trial at the end probably doesn't make a difference.
In theory.
In theory, unless it's say 10 seconds between Quintana and Port, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Or 22 seconds between sort of Port and Froome, and then all of a sudden, the 22K time trial, the guy who's got the best legs then may make a difference. I mean, stranger things have happened. We've seen it come down to that before. We think about the year that Sastre won and Evans missed out. You know, when Sastre got away afterwards, having hidden all tour behind the Schleck brothers and the rest of CSC. So stranger things have happened, but I would expect that because there is so much climbing, you know, 5, 8, 9, 12, 13, 7 and 18, the guys who are the strongest, there should be distance between them, I would have thought.
So then let's look a bit at the players then and the teams around them. Obviously, Chris Froome is a 3-times Tour de France champion, has proved that he can do it time and time again, has a team that has proved that it knows what it's doing at the Tour, and yet he comes into this Tour with no wins basically this year and probably the worst form, well, the worst visible form
that we've ever seen,
him in since,
absolutely.
Since he started.
And look, maybe he's a genius and he knows how hard the final week's going to be and he's got us all foxed. I don't think so because he's a competitive racer and if he has the legs, he's going to kind of race.
Mm.
So it's been a bit of a surprise and that's why I really think Port is actually going in as a favourite. You know, certainly at the very least an equal favourite with Froome, but I think possibly slightly edges him a favourite. I think... Froome has he's been completely off the ball, the 3-time winner. Definitely a rung below Port in the head-to-head battles on the climbs in the couple of races they faced off against each other. But it'd be unwise to underestimate him. I mean, he's seasoned, he's ruthless, and he's got an excellent team at his disposal, an excellent team of climbers, which I think is interesting. And I actually think, though, I think he's a little bit underdone in terms of some of the bigger, harder guys on the flat stages, which is interesting because there are nine of those. I actually think on paper, whereas Froome has a slightly better climbing team at his disposal, I think Port has a better team for on the flats. And if we remember back to Evans's win in 2011, he had the likes of Bergart and those guys who kept him out of trouble and kept him safe through all those kind of early stages. So I think it sort of squares the ledger a little bit. A lot of people look and go, oh, well, Port won't be supported in the mountains. I think, though, the racing is going to be so tough and so brutal on those climbs, it'll thin out to mano a mano pretty quickly. So I don't think he's Froome will have as big a benefit from his climbing team as perhaps he might have in previous tours.
In some previous tours, they've used the climbers as a weapon against the other GC guys by smashing up the early stages or early coals and thinning it out, and Froome getting a free ride. In fact, Richie Porte himself was in that role.
Indeed, performed that role admirably for Froome. That's right.
But if Froome comes in here without Superform himself, that sort of tactic has the possibility of backfiring.
Definitely. It's going to be very, very interesting to see which way they kind of play their cards. That's one of the reasons why, there's so much to like about Richie Porte. And we talked a little bit about the parallels with him and Cadell, they're almost eerie. So in 2011, Cadell won Tirreno Adriatico. He won the Tour de Romandie and he finished second overall at the Criterium du Dauphiné before going on to win the Tour.
Wow.
So Richie this year won the Tour Down Under. He won a stage at Paris-Nice. He won the Tour de Romandie and he was second at the Dauphiné.
Mm,
They're both riding for the same team. Evans was riding for BMC. Port's riding for BMC. They've got similar kind of makeup in their teams too. Like Cadell didn't have the best support there, but he had some kind of couple of loyal attendants in the mountains who did dig deep at the appropriate times. But when the fighting was needed to be happening, he had to do it himself. But he had some big, strong guys in the flat, which, again, I think Port's team is very similar. There's just, I don't know, there's a little bit Abraham Buddy Lincoln assassination about this. I don't know. Call me old-fashioned. But I think it's really, really intriguing. And I'm a little bit of a believer in those kind of omens. And Evans has come out himself and said, I really think Richie can win.
So just to play devil's advocate for a moment, Cadell didn't beat any three-time champions. In this field, there's Alberto Contador is well past his best, but there is a multiple Grand Tour winner in Alberto Contador. There's Chris Froome, who's the current King of the Hill. There's Nairo Quintana, who's won Grand Tours. And so Richie hasn't yet finished on the podium, even in a Grand Tour. And yet he's coming in because of this good form. He's coming in. Is his position as a favourite slightly overstated because of his previous history in Grand Tours?
Who? Froome?
No, Port.
Well, Port, no, look, I think, so Richie finished fifth in the Tour last year, his first chance of going to ride, and he had some bad luck, couple of cases of bad luck. He also had a case of two of his former teammates riding against him and shutting the gate on him in an uphill sprint finish at one stage too, where possibly he could have taken a bit of time or done a bit more damage. So, I think we've always known Port was good enough, but I just think the planets are aligning in the same way they align for Evans. I mean, Evans had been up against kind of great riders and had bad luck and never had the right team. And a lot of people were critical of him, saying he was always kind of whinging and complaining. But I think he was kind of, I think he was corny as it was at the time.
Yeah.
Whereas he then, the planets aligned for him. He had this kind of amazing kind of run of form. I mean, I talked about some of his results. We had other extraordinary results as well that year. And there's just something about, but also, races like Romandie and the Dauphiné are clear indications of form and have been for some time. The Dauphiné uses the same climbs as what we're going to see in the Tour.
Mm.
And Port was strongest. And Froome was not just off, he was way off.
Yes, he was. And it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. We'll see it straight away in stage five on...
Oh, definitely.
Constable Fields. So, but there's also, to throw into this mix, there's teams like Astana and Movistar who have super talented riders who could do almost anything as well. So,
And Orica Scott I include in that as well. So Orica Scott have got Esteban Chavez and Simon Yates. So Chavez, we know how good he is. Unfortunate injury early in the season. He doesn't maybe have the K's in the legs we'd like to see him do to kind of really rip it this year. But also Simon Yates, his brother, had a great result last year. And he's a precocious talent. So that double team, with that excellent team and support, with Cruisinger in the mountains and Heyman, the captain on the road in the flats, and some other really strong, good riders, they're a chance. But likewise, yeah, you've got Valverde and Quintana, and you've got Fuglsang and Aru. And in fact, Aru, although Fuglsang pinched the Dauphiné, Aru to me is the big other threat. I think he's probably the next big one after Froome and Port, the next big favourite. And I think he's a real genuine chance, Aru. He was the winner of the Volta in 2015, and he was in second in the Giro the same year. A brilliant climber, and he's actually coming off his first ever victory last weekend in the Italian National Road Championship.
Oh, wow.
So he'll be wearing the red, white, and green of Italy.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So the last person to come into the Tour as a bit of a favourite wearing his first ever national champions jersey was Nibali in 2014 when he won the Tour. So Aru, not to be underestimated. He's in really good form. He's been racing well, and he's got a very strong team, and the foil of Fuglsang as well. So he's a big threat. He's the biggest threat, I think, for me.
And I just want to throw in one more name because I think he's a really interesting rider, and that is Thibaut Pinot, the Frenchman, who is, on his day, just a sensational climber and like somebody who really knows how to suffer, knows how to really dig deep and really hurt himself. Say he has a stellar day on one of these super tough, on this 101K day on stage 13, and he really smashes up the race. Almost, you know, there's so many possibilities that we really can't, you know, we've got favourites, but there's so many other ones floating around.
Really hard to predict. And the kind of irony is that Pinot's actually worked really hard on one of his weaknesses, the time trial. And he's gotten much better, but there aren't any time trials. No. One of his other weaknesses, though, is his descending. And I think maybe that's where he comes undone. But typically, he seemed to have a bunch of really good days and one really bad one, which is often the case for younger riders. If he's now that little bit older, can he string together a bunch of good days or minimise his losses on his bad day? So definitely a top 10 and a possible top five, and maybe could surprise for the podium.
Now, you can tell me if I'm right or not, but I think that short stage, the 101K stage, is on Bastille Day. And imagine, you know, a Frenchman off the front on Bastille Day. Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, if because that's stage 13, if they have a rest day, so stage 14 should be 14 July. Absolutely. And look, stranger things have happened. But Pinot's look, there's a few other riders too. We talked very briefly about Contador. I think his best days behind him, but he may be a factor or a feature on a couple of stages. Mm. I'd love to see him win a stage. Valverde, we talked about, although he's riding for Quintana, but if Quintana's not there and Valverde's thereabouts, he could do some stuff.
Of course, he never loses
he's old,
but
geez, he's good.
Oh, he's amazing.
Other people to talk about, Rafael Majka, who's riding for Bora, the team of Peter Sagan. He may do something. You've got Rigoberto Urán and Andrew Talansky both riding for Cannondale Drapac. Dan Martin Quickstep, who has his moments, I just can't see him stringing together for 3 weeks. Yeah. And Louis Menchies too on the UAE Team Emirates. So there's some other guys in this. Mm. Like there's 10 or 12 contenders. So then there's three or four serious contenders, another three or four who might upset, and then another kind of half a dozen or so which are potentially factor on different stages.
And there's still your sort of your Roman Bardets and your Pierre Rollins, who might jump out for a stage win as well.
Definitely.
And really get in a breakaway that makes a difference.
Definitely.
So it is a fantastic Tour de France, and I really can't wait to see how it all plays out. But let's be bold and make some predictions. Do you want to name a podium? How about we name our potential winner of the green jersey? See if we can pull out of our own predictions a polka dot jersey winner and then a top three.
So green jersey, that's an easy one.
Yep.
Yeah, Peter Sagan. I mean, he's won the last five in a row. He makes it number six. There's not really a lot of threats. I mean, his biggest threat potentially is Michael Matthews, because Matthews could surprise and pinch a stage winner too, I think. He can be faster on those flat stages and might, if he gets it right, potentially win a stage, which puts him in contention. Mm. But he can also, he's probably the only other fast man that can follow Sagan on those intermediate days or over those climbs. He can hold him there. So I like Matthews to challenge. He was third last year, but maybe he's second this year, again behind Sagan, who takes out the green jersey.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really hard to look past Peter Sagan.
Mountains jersey, that's Mountains a bit of an interesting one too. So just with some of the other kind of young climbers and stuff, I don't know. But also the sort of tour with the amount of climbing with the GC guys battling it out, it wouldn't surprise me for the actual overall winner to actually potentially take the Mountains jersey again. And so in thinking that line of thinking, then I wouldn't be surprised to see Port in the Mountains jersey. Because Port, I'm actually, you know, I'm bowler tipping, hand on my heart, a little Aussie battler. I'm tipping Port to win. If as long as all the bad luck he's experienced over the years kind of balances out and he just gets one little piece of good luck.
Yep.
And that'd he,
be reasonable.
Yeah, and he rides to his potential, and what we've seen on the road from this year, I really think he can win. But I think Froome and Aru are the biggest threats, and Aru even possibly more than Froome. But Froome, mate, you know, he just might have surprises all. There are examples of guys who, you know, a month out haven't been great and have kind of come good, especially in that final third week if he's timed it. If he's got, you know, David Brailsford's marginal gains out the wazoo, you know, maybe he pulls it off. But I think he's looking as...
Depends on who's driving a packet of tablets to somewhere in France.
Well, I don't know about that, but you know, this is as brittle as we've seen him, yes. And this is a guy who's a champion and a very competitive racer, but he just hasn't had it this year. So I think that's probably my podium is Port, Aru, and Froome, potentially that order as well.
Yep.
And what else does that leave us?
I think that's about it. Young rider.
Young rider. There's a few young guys who go there. Well, probably the Yates, I think.
Yep.
So I see him to possibly
Simon
take
Yates.
Simon Yates from Orica Scott to take the white jersey. But it's going to be interesting to see him in the Tour and with that great team. I mean, Yates might surprise. I think he's a potential top five if he gets it all right.
Yep.
Not sure if he can squeak the podium, but with the company he's in against, very experienced, very good riders, but he's definitely a potential top five.
I think it's a really difficult top 10 to crack even because there's so many of these guys like Contador and like Valverde who you know are going to be in the top 10.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Valverde is very rarely outside the top five, basically.
Absolutely.
And so it's really hard to dislodge your Romain Bardets, your Thibaut Pinots and Aru and Fuglsang and all these guys. So I think the top 10, if Simon Yates gets in the top 10, I think it's a fantastic ride. If Chavez gets going, who knows what's going to happen because he's a fantastic talent.
Definitely. So he's the one. So Chavez, if he kind of pulls it all together, he could even be a podium. But just that injury earlier in the season has definitely cost him. I'd love to see him come to the Tour fit. And this is kind of, it was almost like, again, the perfect Tour for someone like him with his kind of characteristics.
Yeah.
Perfect. So I feel he's probably feeling a little bit robbed with an injury because this was the year that maybe he could have.
I think he's got a few more years of development to go.
Young man, so he's got plenty to go. But you're right, though. It's interesting, like reflecting on that. I mean, this is potentially the best top 10 we're going to have from a tour in a very long time with some real quality names. In that top 10. And I think if we extrapolate that out, that then gives us an indication, I think, of what the quality of the racing is going to be like because these are guys that have delivered and can deliver and know how to race and know how to make the race. And so us as the fans, you know, sitting up watching these extraordinary stages in the mountains, we're the ones who get the benefit because it should be hot.
Us. Yeah, it should be fantastic. Look, I'm going to say that I think that that Froome, for me, is still the favourite simply because of his pedigree. And so my podium, I'm going to suggest Froome to beat Port with Quintana to finish third. And I'm going to say Thibaut Pinot is my selection for the polka dot jersey. I think he's set for a big one. And so that's what I'm hoping for because I think he's a really exciting racer. So I'm like you, just totally stoked looking forward to this event. I think Simon Yates is a really good selection for the white jersey and let's hope that he also is able to have a good tour. So what are your strategies? What are your best tips for how to watch the tour, Nick? Do you sit up and you know, I'm going to state what may be a controversial opinion to some people, but I am so stoked that Matt Keenan and Robbie McEwen are calling the Tour this year.
Oh, Nick, absolutely, I agree. I think, and it's been time for a while.
For about 5 years.
When the announcement kind of went out on social media, my immediate reaction was a positive one. And I was just reflecting on when did I think they were ready. And for me, it goes back to actually last year, 2016. Their call of Matty Heyman's win in Paris-Roubaix is one of the best calls of any bike race I've ever heard. And that was the moment for me when I thought, you guys are the future of English commentary. Cycling,
yep.
And I think it's great that they have got the gig on the biggest race of the year, and I think they'll do a brilliant job. I think Keenan has got better and better and better. I used to find him sometimes a little kind of one note, but he's kind of his modulation in his voice now. He's always had this extraordinary knowledge, and that's he's built on that. He's a really great guy, very personable. Yes. We've sort of met him down at the Tour Down Under, and he'll chat with anyone. Loves talking cycling. Really great guy. And Robbie's our kind of hometown hero. We've gotten to know him a little bit since he's retired, in and around kind of cyclocross and doing different things too. He's a great guy, but he's a fantastic analyst too, and with those 9 flat finishes too, he's going to have lots of great insights into the racing for the sprint finishes. I think it's going to be great commentary, and really excited for them. But tips for watching the race, first tip is don't go too hard too early. It's a 3-week event and you don't want to spend it all in the first week. The second tip is don't be afraid to rely on technology. If you've got access to a hard drive or you have a recorder, use that to pick and choose your kind of stages. And then if you're looking for somewhere you really want to sit up and see some amazing racing and kind of get into the vibe and share your tour snacks on Twitter and see what everyone else is doing, you know, it's really 5, 8, 9, 12, 13, 17 and 18 of the stages, the big kind of climbing stages to keep an eye out for, and potentially stage 3 early. So a first week stage would be stage 3.
Yep.
Keep some wind in your sails though for that final week for 17 and 18. I think they're probably 3 that will tell quite well. And there's lots of different ways to watch it, of course. You can sit up and watch it live. SBS do their sort of highlights program. I think it's typically 5 o'clock, I think, for an hour. So you can do that. But, get into it. The other thing, if you've got a device, download the SBS kind of tour tracker, because it has all the results, all the updates. It shows your profiles of stages, gives you reviews, even has video, and will show you the tracking of the stage. So that's a great little kind of way to consume information around the race while you're watching it too.
That's your iPad on your lap while you're watching the tour. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I agree. I think that you don't need to watch every stage live. Just put yourself on a social media blackout from when you go to bed to when you watch the stage there. So for me, my cyclist routine is I often get up early to go for a bike ride anyway. So during the tour, I quite often will have recorded the previous night and still get up at 5 and spend an hour going through what's happened the previous night. And I think for me, that's a good way to manage it in my normal routine rather than having a lot of late nights.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a big fan of the early morning pre-work kind of watches, zip through the actual stage.
Yes.
So I'll do that. So I'll do a combination. There have been years when I think I've sat up and watched every stage, but hey, we're all getting a bit older and have a bit more responsibility and it's a bit hard. So there'll definitely be some stages I do that, but I'll record every stage.
Yes.
And some I'll watch in the morning. Some I'll even watch, I'll zip through or either catch the highlights when I get home. Like the sprint stages too, you only need to see the last 5Ks and really only the last 500 metres.
Exactly. But for the mountain stages, you never know when a mountain stage is going to turn out to be a classic. So my advice is always record the mountain stages.
Definitely.
Because they might turn out to be something you want to keep forever.
And that's the other thing too. I think one of the great things, I think we're seeing all the stages, all the entire stage with SBS this year. Because oftentimes, the coverage would start, they've raced 100Ks, and we've missed the first 50Ks is often the most exciting racing. They're guys trying to break away on some of the early mountains, early climbs. There's amazing racing. And so that's always great to tune in too. So often you can even sort of sit up and catch the first hour, hour and a half of the stage,
then
see some great, hit record, then go to bed and then kind of pick it up in the morning.
Fantastic stuff. Well, we're looking forward to all of that. Nick, I hope we can catch up with you at some stage during the tour as well for a bit of an update on how we think everything's going along. But for now, that's it from this episode of the Bridge Treadley podcast. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think. Scoop@bridgetreadley.com for your story ideas. Interact with us on Facebook, facebook.com/BrizTreadley. My name's Andrew Demick. My guest has been Nicholas O'Donnell, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now. We'll be right back.
all aboard the Tour de France train for Dusseldorf.